Thank you. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really delighted to be here. I thought I'd forget to talk by the time I got here. And I want to set the record straight, too. Barbara spoke for 8 minutes. I was watching the clock.
I have announcements.
She'll never, ever, ever going to make 15 years lying like that. I want to tell you what a pleasure it is to be here. It really is. I run into some old friends, and it's just a delight to be here. And the other speakers have really done it for me. I could go home right now and have everything I came for, I promise you. Vince, who I met fairly recently in South Carolina, I consider him a close personal friend. We just hit it off immediately. And Nancy's talk, I hadn't heard Nancy before, and her talk this afternoon was just wonderful. And I really hope that if you weren't here that you'll get that tape. It's just a marvelous talk about ego deflation at depth and about the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of the Midtown Group from Wilmington, North Carolina. And if you're ever in town in Wilmington on either Monday or Thursday nights, we meet at 7 o'clock at the Presbyterian Church. And we'd love to have you there, and I promise you we'll make you feel at home. I was telling somebody today that we had some people visit from California, and our meetings are from 7 until 8, and after the meeting we invited them to come out with us for Mexican food, which is a bad habit we've gotten into. And they told us they couldn't. They wanted to rush out to the ocean to watch the sun go down. True story. I was, it's a nice hotel, a little warm, but a really nice hotel. Some of the people were strange. I was this morning I got up and I exercised. You might look at me and wonder why, but I got up and exercised this morning and for about an hour. And then, I went and sat in the, whirlpool and I forgot I had my money in my pocket So I was up in my room using a hairdryer to dry it, which I think is a pretty normal thing to do. And the lady came in to clean up the room, she kept watching me. And I just felt as though I owed her an explanation. I'm still an alcoholic, and I said to her, "It's dirty money." And I said, I promised myself once if I ever had any, I'd keep it clean. She never cleaned up my room. She just left, and I never saw her again. I was born in a small town in Ohio. You can tell that I'm probably not from North Carolina. I'm a naturalized citizen. My wife is from North Carolina, But I was born in a small town in Ohio. It's on the Ohio River, just south of Pittsburgh, where Nancy was born. The name of the town is Martin's Ferry. If you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother. It's been canceled. And I'm the eldest son and second child in a family of 11 children. We're Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. I will give you a hint. It's got something to do with bingo, but I'll leave it alone. If you ever looked at a bank account, you would say that I grew up in poverty, and that's what I thought for many years. The problem was I didn't know the whole story, and the whole story is I grew up with great wealth. I had a mother and a father who loved me very much. I had a mother who every day that I was there, she'd tell me she loved me, and if I let her, she'd hug me and kiss me. I'll tell you, I got sober too soon. I told this up the road in Danville about 5 years ago, and I really felt bad after I told it. But a terrible thing. I was, you know how you get fired up. I don't know if you've ever been to that thing. It's going on right now. You might want to go. But the first Saturday of every month, they have a speaker, and it's really a neat deal, and they have birthday nights and all that stuff, and it's really a lot of fun, and I get all fired up at these things. I mean, you know, I'll come here, I'll be mopey, and then pretty soon I'm flying high and just all fired up, and I was feeling real good, and I got up there, and I said, there were about 1,800 people there, something like that, and I said, you know, things have changed. I said, you know, now you hear a lot about healing the child within. I said, you know, when I came and they told me I had to discipline a little bastard within. And 300 people got up and stormed out. And remember, Penny? And the other 1,500 applauded. It was the strangest thing. So if any of you were there, I want to tell you, I'm really sorry that I said that. I mean, it was really out of line. I mean, we don't have opinions on things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was really out of line, and I felt awful. And the thing I felt worst about is most of you left your teddy bears behind. You just got up and turned on it. You know, the thing I remember about growing up mostly was being afraid. And I mean, I don't know why. That's what I remember mostly, being afraid. I always felt as though there was something I was supposed to know that I didn't know. And you knew it. And it caused me great problems. I remember as a little kid, there was something lived under my bed. I don't know if you ever had any of those things in your house, but it lived in my bed, and it would turn a light out. It would move around. You could hear it moving around down here. And I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little leg over the side of the bed. Now it's history. And I knew that. And, like one morning, everybody would be having breakfast and they'd say, "Where's Keith?" And they say, "Oh, no, the thing under the bed got him." And I also knew I couldn't talk about it. I knew I had to keep all of this stuff secret. I knew that. And so I grew up with all these secrets and all these fears. And I didn't know you could talk about fears. Now, nobody ever told me that. I just assumed that. I thought you could talk about successes, but you couldn't talk about problems and you couldn't talk about fears. Those were things that you hid. Nobody knew about them. Nobody. And so I was this little kid whose ears stuck out. I looked like a cab with the back doors open, and my sister. I had an older sister. That's like having a plague, and she used to call me Dumbo and things, and it was just awful. And it's a sad life. It really is. I think about it, I want to cry. Yeah, it's really rough. Then I went off to this school that had these nuns, and there's something else again. I remember I had one in high school. Her name was Sister Victoria. Sister Victoria was a librarian, and used to serve detention in library. And I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria. And if we'd have had any money, I would have been an acting out adolescent. We were poor, so I was just a punk. And so I was in trouble a lot, and I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria, and she was a strange woman. She'd run around and say weird things, like they do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, just say weird stuff, unprovoked. She would say things like, "Every boy is a prince and every girl is a princess because we have a father who's a king." Make you want to throw up, you know? And then when you served detention with Sister Victoria, you had to make rosary beads. You know what those are? Those are things that Catholics pray on. And there are 10 beads in each decade, and there are 5 decades. And so she'd give us wire and pliers and beads, and I'd make these rosary beads. And I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria, and I got to be good at it. And she used to put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was contagious. And so put me behind a magazine rack, and I'm making rosary beads, and I made all mine with 11 beads and all the decades. And I did this for 4 years, and you know, by the time I graduated, I had hundreds and hundreds of mutant rosary beads, and they sent them all around the world to the missions and things, and this dumb numb never caught on, you know, you can't let stuff like this go, So just before I left school, I went to her and I told her what I'd been doing, and she smiled and she said, I know what you've been doing. You've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries, and I know why. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest idea why I do this thing. And she said, you're doing it so people all over the world are going to say extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you hate people like that, you know? Then she said something to me. It was very, very frightening. She took my hands in her hands, and she's one of those people. She's a spiritual person, and she really walked with God, and everything she did was for the honor and glory of God. And she smiled, and she said, when I first met you, she said, I put this metal on my beads. They wore those long beads that used to bang against the desk when you were taking tests. And she put a medal of St. Jude on there. It was a patron saint of lost causes. And she said, whenever I got to this medal, I prayed for you, because one day God's going to use you and send you all over the world to tell his children how much he loves them. And so, in honor of Sister Victoria, I'd like to say that God loves you very much. It terrified me. I didn't want any responsibility. I wanted to be a hero without being brave. And I wanted to be successful without any effort. I mean, I just wanted it to happen to me, because I didn't want to have to risk anything. I'd like to talk a little bit about my first drinking experience. Nancy started a lot younger than me, although I did have my first drink when I was 5 years old. I was home with my dad and my brother, Dumb Denny. Dumb Denny's a year younger than I am, and my mom was out. She was either to bingo or having a baby or something. And we're sitting around a kitchen table where life happened in my house. And we're playing games and things. And I think my dad thought he just might be cute. So he gave us each a beer. I drank mine and nothing happened. Nothing. My brother Denny was having a very different experience. I looked over and Denny slid out of the chair. And he was rolling around under the table, and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And my dad kind of panicked, and, you know, he wrestled him to the ground. He took his clothes off, and he took him up, and he put him in his crib, and he said, now, you know, don't tell your mother about this. And Denny's singing and carrying on and laughing. And I never forget this as long as I live. I was in the same room. Hell, where we lived, everybody was in a room. And I looked over, and Denny stood up in his little crib, and he urinated on the floor, you know. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. Yeah. And you know, it's the saddest story. Denny just never made it. You know, he just never made it. I'll tell you, he did some weird things. I'll share some of them with you. He grew up and he went to one college. He had one major. You know, he graduated in 4 years. You know, he went to one graduate school. Graduated. He was offered like 9 jobs, and he took one. You know, and last year he retired as an officer in a large international corporation. And the strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers. You know. I, on the other hand, had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. Now, the other thing I remember was that my father never told me he loved me. Boy, that'll set you free, I tell you. And I left home, and I knew I had to leave home, and the reason I had to leave home was because I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. And it seemed everybody else did. You know, everybody around me knew exactly what they were going to do. That's frightening. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And so I had to go away. And my thought was, if you go away, they don't know you don't know what you're doing. They think you're doing it. And somebody will say, what's Keith doing? I said, well, I don't know, but he went away, so he must be doing it. And And I didn't know how to go away. I mean, I'd never been more than 100 miles from my home growing up. I went to Cleveland once, and the game was rained out. And, I mean, that's the way my life worked. And so I decided I'd go into service, because back then, everybody went into service. All the men went into service. It wasn't if, it was where and when. Those were the questions. And so I took my very first in-depth inventory. I stood in front of the mirror. I took my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways, and I stuck my chest out, and I was 5 feet, 1 inch tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So so I went over and joined the Marine Corps. And I was 17 years old, so my parents had to sign. And I failed to share with my parents what I had decided to do. And a recruiter showed up, and my poor mother just lost it. She fell apart like a cheap suit and just cried But they signed because I asked them to. And my mother cried all night. She just cried, kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him. He's so tiny, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." So the next morning, with that vote of confidence, we got into a taxi cab and went over to Wheeling, West Virginia. And I got on a Trailways bus and I went to Pittsburgh. And it was a very bad year, and they took you if you had a pulse. And so that afternoon, I was sworn into the United States Marine Corps, just terrified. I had no earthly idea what was. The only thing I knew about the Marine Corps was they took a certain number of young men down to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. That's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps. And that night, I was sworn in at 4 o'clock, and three guys from Pittsburgh were sworn in. They understood the big picture. I never understood the big picture. And so they said to me, "Look, the train's not leaving until midnight. What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, we're going to go over and have a few beers and a sandwich." And I said, "That's just what I was thinking." And so I followed them over to this bar, and that's when the miracle happened. And if you're an alcoholic, you know what I mean. I mean, you heard it described beautifully today and last night. That's when my life changed, and it changed in a way that was to determine the course of action for the rest of my life. I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, but I'll tell you, that place is filled with real men. You know the kind, they got tattoos, they spit on the floor, I mean, real men. And all of them have real women with them. Those are women who hang around with real men. And guys like me got what was left. And I remember we went in, and this place is filled with real men. And a bartender came over. He's a real man. He said, "What do you want?" And I thought, "Oh, my God, a quiz." Yeah. I just thought that when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper and put your name in the upper left-hand corner, and they're going to ask you a lot of questions." And I studied a lot. I just never studied the right stuff. And I didn't know how to answer that question, so I did what I always did. I looked at the other guys, and they ordered a beer, so I did too. You know, years later, a psychologist was to scratch his chin. You know how they do it. And say, "Why do you think you drank in the first place?" And I thought it was, "Dad never told me he loved me. Mother had a square nipple." I wasn't sure. I knew that there was, you know. There was some deep reason, dark reason why I drank in the first place. And I drank and I asked myself, and you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out why I drank in the first place. I mean, I'm in a bar in Pittsburgh filled with real men. And everybody at the table is having a beer, and I just did not have the internal intestinal fortitude to ask for a sarsaparilla. That's why I drank in the first place. And what I know now is it doesn't matter why. What matters is what happened after I drank. And somewhere between the second and the third drink, my life changed in a very dramatic style. I stood up. I didn't mean to stand up. I just stood up. And I don't think I could have kept from standing up. I just stood up, and I looked, and the floor was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And my right shoulder was out there, and my left shoulder was out there, and the muscles were rippling through my body, you know. And that mind that had been filled with so much fear and everything, it was like, boom, it was instantly. And I remember saying, "Of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? It makes perfect sense." And all of a sudden, I knew all about everything. I knew about God. I knew about boys and girls. I knew about it, everything, politics, everything, you know. And I looked around the room, and my heart just broke. Because the room was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. All of them had women with them looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. You know? My sponsor is Tom I from Aberdeen, North Carolina. I think he's the finest member of AA I've ever known. And Tom's only wrong about one thing. Tom and I often discuss this. He said to me, he said, "You could have quit drinking then." And I said, "Who the hell would have wanted to?" I mean, that's the first time I ever felt normal in my whole life. And that's what I felt. And I went from table to table that night sharing information with those people. I mean, I had answers to questions they hadn't even thought of. It was amazing, and it was wonderful. And somebody said to me, "Keith, it's 11 o'clock. We better get to the train station." And so I said to these people, "Well, I have to leave now. I have to go make the world safe for democracy." And it seemed to me, and this may not be entirely accurate. It's something like Barbara's timekeeping ability, but it seems to me that those people were crying, asking me not to go. It's just the way it seemed, now. And I went, and the Marine Corps had provided me with a Pullman coach. I had no earthly idea what a Pullman coach was or what you did with it, but it didn't matter because by the time I got to the train, I was in a blackout. And the next thing I knew, I woke up on the floor of this Pullman coach the Marine Corps had provided for me, and something awful had happened. Someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever it was had wet me too. And again, I was 17 years old, and I was terrified. But I had a piece of information I hadn't had before. So I changed my clothes, and I got off the train, and the guys are waiting on the platform. And they said, "Look, we're going to go over and have a few beers for breakfast. You want to come along?" We're in Washington, D.C. And I thought, well, what do I know? I'm from out of town. So I just followed them over there. And that night, same thing had happened to me, and I fell off a train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. And it was a very rude man there that had sent to greet us. And I don't know what happened. Somebody moved the bottom step or something, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks. Could have happened to anybody. And this man was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who went down there to die for their country. And I got up and I brushed myself off and I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd probably get a lot further if he treated us with a little respect. And he never seemed to grasp the essence of what it was I was telling him. I think it's because he was screaming so much. And they say you learn from every situation. I certainly learned from that one. I learned you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned. And you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. And I've always been grateful that he didn't have me doing sit-ups. I'd have drowned. So I was launched into the Marine Corps. And I must tell you, I loved the Marine Corps. I loved everything about it. So if there's any question about me needing to be here, that should wrap it up for you. I mean, I just loved it. For the very first time in my life, I knew exactly what was expected of me. All my life, my previous 17 years, I'd been guessing at what was expected. I never knew. And in the Marine Corps, they have a very clear idea of what's expected of you, and they're not a bit hesitant to share it with you. And so they told me precisely what was expected. And once I knew what was expected, I could do it. And it was wonderful for me. It was a tremendous experience. Paris Island Boot Camp was a tremendous experience for me. I grew a few inches, and I packed on some weight, and I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award. And I'm just going to stay in the Marine Corps for 100 years. The problem was I was an alcoholic. And let me tell you what being an alcoholic means. And being an alcoholic means that you'll enter into a way of life. And as Nancy described it so beautifully this afternoon, And you'll fall madly in love with that way of life. And with great enthusiasm. I mean, enthusiasm which carries the day. And gradually or not so gradually, I began to violate every principle associated with that way of life. And I would eventually leave that way of life, and I would blame them for what happened to me. And I worked hard in the Marine Corps, and I worked to get a commission, and every promotion I got was a meritorious promotion. And I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps, and I was going to be the youngest officer. I was going to be commissioned before the boys I went to high school with, most of whom went to college, graduated from college. That was my great goal. And I was there. The problem was I was also alcoholic. And what that meant was I began to violate all the principles associated with this way of life, and up to and including I drank in a combat zone, and I drank myself into a blackout, and I took a group of men out on patrol. By the grace of God, nobody was killed, but we did come under fire. And I woke up the next morning fully clothed with a 45 in my holster with a hammer back, and four rounds missing out of the magazine. And that isn't the way I normally slept. And I knew that it was over. And I made up a good excuse, and I turned down the commission, and I got out. We were talking at dinner. It probably saved my life. That was 1965. And I'd have been commissioned in December of 65 and probably dead in January. But the point is that alcoholism cost me the first career I ever wanted. And the rest of my drinking is exactly the same. It's crazy and all the rest of it, but it's exactly the same way. I fell in love with a way of life. I got married, and we had two beautiful little children. And when the second daughter was born, Kimberly, she had a very bad disease, a highly membrane disease. And back then, 28 years ago, she was born at the hospital in which I worked, which was Georgetown University Hospital. It was a great teaching hospital. And they had an experimental machine called a negative respirator, very common now, but then it wasn't common. And they had put it together 3 days before she was born. And the chief resident there was a young woman I'd gone to high school with. And she, Mary Kate, came to me, and a neonatal expert came to me and said, "We'd like to put your little girl on the machine because she's not going to live. And she probably won't live anyway. And if she does live, she'll probably be retarded. May we put her on the machine?" And my wife by that time was in a state of shock. She wandered around with a 1,000-yard stare. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "You know, do whatever you need to do." And I learned a lot about myself the next few days because our offices were across from the nursery. And I could sit in the office with a light out at night. And I didn't drink for a few days, which was a rarity. And I watched this little kid fight for every life and every breath. And I was terrified of this little thing. She weighed 1.5 pounds, and I was terrified. I didn't want to be near her. And the only reason I went and held her or touched her at all was because I didn't want to look bad in front of the people I worked with. But I was terrified. I mean, I wanted to rush to this woman I was married to, and I wanted to say to her, "We'll see this together. I'm your husband." I watched my father, and that's the kind of husband my father was. My mother was never alone. With my father, he was there for every crisis. And boy, when you have 11 kids, you got a few crises that pop up. And he was there for every one. He was there for every time his kid had a problem. He was there. And that's the kind of father and husband I wanted to be, and I couldn't be. Alcoholism had ripped the insides out of me. If there was ever anything there, it was gone. And I remember how I cowered in that office in the dark. And I learned something else too. I learned that a guy like me doesn't have a chance. Nothing works for a guy like me. And I was raised Catholic, and I was an altar boy, and I was all those things. And as a kid, I used to visit the Blessed Sacrament. I'd run by the church. Whenever I went by the church, I'd run in, and I'd kneel down for a few minutes. And I loved being in front of the tabernacle in the Catholic church. And I hadn't been there in a while now, and we had a chapel in the hospital. And I went down, and it was late at night, and I went in the chapel, and I got on my knees, and I begged God to let this little girl live. And I said, "I'll do anything if you'll let her live. If you'll let her live, I'll stop drinking." And I was drunk in less than 24 hours. I drank when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. So what I learned was there's no hope for a guy like me. You know, great French mathematician, philosopher Blaise Pascal said, "God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned the favor." And I had created a God in the image of the sickness I had, and that is that a God that would kill a little kid because her dad was sick. And Kimberly didn't die. As a matter of fact, she went on, and she's not retarded. She's an honor student, honor graduate from Auburn University. I always say to her that I'm not sure that you can be an honor student and still not be retarded from Auburn University, but that's another story. One of the most blessed things of all was this Christmas she presented me with my first granddaughter. But I knew I could never stop drinking. You know, if you can't stop drinking for that, what can you stop? And what happened is what inevitably happens, and that is that the string ran out, and I won't take you through that. It was no fun living in it. It's no fun listening to. Suffice it to say, I ended up living in the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and my life was virtually over. And like Barbara, I was 29 years of age when the miracle happened for me. I've been drinking around the clock, don't remember much of anything that took place. I was saying I'm told I was kicked out of Blues Alley. I was telling B.B. King he couldn't play that damn guitar. I don't remember that. If I ever run into B.B., I'll apologize, but I'm sure it's probably maimed him. But I don't know what all happened. I really don't. And at the very end, I was ordering booze by phone and unable to answer the phone, and just the usual crazy stuff. And I went into the bathroom one morning, and it was over. It was just time to die. I used to think that suicide was a big deal, but, you know, it's not for an alcoholic. It's just the next thing. That's my alcoholism lasted 12 years, and this is about how it went. One day I was in the NCO club, and I went up and I ordered a double scotch on the rocks, and the bartender said to me, he said, "That'll be 70 cents in your Marine Corps career." And I thought, that's about right, and I paid it. And then sometime later, I went for a bottle of gin or something, and he said, "That'll be $7.50 in your wife and your children." And I thought, that's about right. You know, I mean, whatever it costs to get back to Pittsburgh that first night, that's about right. And then one day, I don't know, I went and ordered a bunch of hooch from a liquor store, and they said, you know, it'll be, you know, $20 in your life. And I thought, that's about right. And it was just the next thing, that's all. And I went into that what passed for a bathroom, and I had a medicine cabinet full of drugs. I worked in hospitals, as had my estranged wife. And they noticed I had a nervous condition. I'd bang my eyes on a microscope in the morning and things like that. So they gave me all these wonderful pills, and I never took them. I know there are people in the audience think that's the saddest story they ever heard, but I was afraid of them. I just never took them, but I had them all, and I went in, and I decided that I would just take them all. And I said aloud, "You're 29, at least it'll be over." And a voice said, a woman's voice, very clearly, it wasn't in my head, it was outside of me, said, "When you're 29, it's not supposed to be over, it's supposed to be starting." An incredible calm came over me, and I remembered that my estranged wife had given me a couple phone numbers when I left. And she said, her parting words were, "I can't help you, maybe they can." And I ran out, and I pulled a drawer open, and I could only find one number, and I called it. And it happened to be a little treatment center in a condemned hotel outside of Washington, D.C. There are a lot of speakers who say a lot of bad things about treatment centers, which intrigues me because we don't have opinions on things like that. But I can't say anything bad about them. I really can't, because I don't know what would have happened to me if those people weren't there. And I called and I spoke to a woman, and she arranged for me to come there. And she said something strange to me. "Do you need help stopping?" I said, "I don't think so." Now, I don't know where I got that. I hadn't stopped. I've never stopped. And I went through the next 3 days, and I did what a lot of drunks do. I heard things, saw things, you know. I had to get some money, so I'm trying to get a loan on my car, and I'm in a bank, and I'm hearing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, beautiful rendition. I'm with it, and it occurs to me they don't have Muzak, and I'm the only one enjoying this. And it's coming out of the officer's inkwell. There was an orchestra in his inkwell, and I knew that wasn't normal. But then all of a sudden I knew that it was time to go, and I went, and I got, took me 5 hours to go 30 miles. I had what they used to call the running fits. Now they call them anxiety attacks, but this was before Valium, and so they were just a running fits. And I could only go about a mile, and I began to tremble and shake and be sick, and I wet my pants, and you know, just a nightmare. And it took me 5 hours to go 30 miles, and I got there, and they loaded me on a bus and took me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I worked in a medical profession, so there was no reason I should have known about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I didn't. I did not know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. I had a big book because my ex-wife found an old one in a trash room. I never know what happened to that person, And when she asked me to leave, I took it with me. But I thought it was a book of a history of an organization that used to exist. I didn't know AA existed. So they take me off to this AA meeting, and again, that's when the miracle happened. Because I met an old man who stood outside that meeting, and he shook my hand. And it didn't sound like much. And I remember he had this really obnoxious habit. You see it around here a lot, of looking you in the eye. You know the kind. And I was a shoe guy. I looked at shoes. And this guy's looking me in the eye. And he said to me, "You're new, aren't you?" And I said, "Oh, my God, he's psychic." You know? I mean, I got off a bus, you know, with a bunch of other people. And I looked like a madman. And he just picked it out. I was new. And I went into that meeting, and that was the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I ever went to. And by the grace of God and three extremely mean sponsors, from that time till this, I haven't had to take a drink of alcohol. And this last month, May the 13th, it was 25 years. And you know, that can't happen. That just can't happen. They had a big deal. Some of the guys I sponsor got together, and they had a roast, and I was the roastor, or roastee, I guess that would be, huh? And they brought in some really mean people. My sponsor, Tom I, was there, and Sandy B., who was my second sponsor, and Ray O'Keefe, Ray O.K., who never let sponsor me, and Mike W., who's known me since I was sober less than a year, and they were brutal. It's awful what they said. The things they said about me shouldn't be repeated, so I won't. But it was really wonderful. We had a great time, and a guy named Alan L. from Washington, the first guy who I ever sponsored, came down and spoke, and it was just great to see him. And so I've been doing a lot of thinking the last couple of weeks about my life and what's happened in my life and how I can't be here. I was so seriously ill when I got to you. It's unbelievable. I look back now, I can't believe it. And you know exactly how to handle me and exactly how to deal with me every step of the way. And it always seemed wrong to me. It always seemed to me like you didn't quite really understand exactly what I was trying to convey to you. But you always knew exactly what to do. You know, back then, they didn't begin meetings by saying, "Does anybody here have a problem?" You know, where I'm from now, they do that sometimes. Somebody will lead a meeting. I'll say, "Anybody here have a problem?" And I'll say, "I got alcoholism. Makes them crazy." You know? And then I start them now. Say, "Anybody here have a solution?" But you know, what happens is somebody's got a problem. Mother had a square nipple. And you know, and then you spend the next hour, 50 untrained psychiatrists offer an opinion on that. But what they used to do was at the end of the meeting, they'd say, "Is there anybody here who has something that might make them drink before 8:30 tomorrow night?" And I'd always put up my hand. They'd say, "Yes, Keith, what is it?" And I'd say, "I can't sleep." And they'd take turns. You know how they are. Take turns saying, "Nobody ever died from not sleeping." And you want to be careful how you talk to somebody who hadn't been sleeping. One night I screamed, "No, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping." They were wonderful with me. I remember there was a man named Dick L. who did an extraordinary thing. I couldn't believe this happened. I went to a meeting one week. I was sober a month. I went to a meeting, and he greeted me at the door, and he asked me my name. And I went back, and he talked to me for a few minutes. Where do you work? Do you have any children? And I went back the next week, and he called me by name. And he said, "Are you still at the university?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "How are Kelly and Kimberly?" I said, "Well, I hadn't been able to see them." "Oh, I bet they're okay." Yeah. And then he took me over to a group of people. This is 25 years ago. It was Art P. It was Dan C., who became my first sponsor. There was Bill W. There was a guy named David P., who I saw just a few weeks ago. And he introduced me. And he told these men that I was his friend. I was his new friend. And I never forgot that. I never forgot that. I can tell you what those five men were wearing that night. Because that's the very first time in a long, long time I felt like anything or anybody. You know, I had gotten awards. I had done a lot of things. But I knew that none of that was real. None of that was about me. That was about me getting over on them. But this was about me. There was a man who had absolutely no reason in the world to know my name, and he remembered my name. So I really try hard. I have a mind like a sieve, but I really try hard to remember the new guy's name and to call him by name the next week. And sometimes I write it down and write down a brief description, which I go over before the next meeting. But it's just critically important to me. And And I was thrust into a way of life that exceeded anything I ever could have imagined. I got to do this. And it was greater than anything I ever could have imagined. It's hard for me to begin talking about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, not being able to... I remember early on, we had a lot of old-timers here tonight. You know, we had 52 years. God, I mean, he was sober 14 years before I was born. Oh, I'm... Yeah. Barbara and I are going to do our 10 steps tonight. And now we got guys 40-some years and 30-some years, you know, and they're old-timers. Okay, those are old-timers. People with 30 and more years are old-timers, okay? And if you're new, I want to warn you about old-timers, okay? They're not nice people. They aren't. And one of the things they do, like Barbara, they lie. They do. They say things that aren't true. For example, they say, I still need to go to meetings. They don't need to go to meetings. The only reason they go to meetings is they like to watch people like you and me suffer. That's why they go to meetings. And if you don't believe me, find one of them after the meeting and tell them a problem. The first thing they do is laugh. Okay! If you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They love problems about sex, you know. And the answer is always the same. No sex. No sex. They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have it either. You know? I've always had bad judgment. So I went to an old-timer. Big mistake. And I said, I was telling this guy, I had a problem. He said, what's the problem? He get to the point. I said, I'm impotent, which will really put a crimp in your sex life, you know. And I was 29 years old and impotent. And he laughed. Ah! You know? And he said, a lot of us had that problem. It'll go away. I said, well, when? I thought it was important, you know. And he said, what, do you got a full social calendar? You know? So I used to go to this guy, you know, with a problem. I went to a problem. I remember one problem. I can't remember what it was. It was a big problem. It hit in July of 1973. It was all over. And a lot of people had it. And I can't remember what it was, though. But I went to the old-timer, and I remember he shook his head. He said, I don't know the answer to that. And I tell you what I used to think. I used to think that Alcoholics Anonymous is where you recognize a problem, and you have to get an answer for that problem. If you don't, you have to drink. Now, nobody told me that. I just figured that out all on my own. And so I had this problem, and the clock's running, you know. And I thought, my God, what am I going to do? So I went running around looking for an answer to this problem. And the old-timer said, I don't know it. He said, but there's a fellow down in Washington who knows it. He's down at the Metropolis Club. And the Metropolis Club now is on 7th Street down in D.C., but then it was in a condemned building next to the Trailways bus station. The only floor that wasn't condemned was the second floor where the Metropolis Club was, you know. So I went running down the Metropolis Club, and I asked for this man. I got about 45 minutes to live, you know. And they said he's out on a 12-step call. And I said, what's he doing that for? And they said, sit down, he'll be right back, there's a meeting. So he came in, he dragged a new drunk, and I ran over and I said to him, I said, I got to talk to you. I said, I got a problem. And he said, well, we'll talk about it after the meeting. I said, well, I'm not sure I'll be alive. He said, you sit next to me. He said, nobody sitting next to me ever died. So I sat next to him, and when the meeting was over, I told him, he's a beautiful guy, he's a black man, had white eyes. I could see him today. And I told him my problem. And he said, you know, boy, he said, I don't know the answer to that. And I said, oh, you're my last hope. He said, but I got a suggestion. I said, what's that? He said, don't drink, even if your ass falls off. I remember driving home thinking, that's the most profound thing I ever heard in my life. You know? And I learned that Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about solving problems. You know, I mean, hell, we have the attention span of a gnat. You know, You know, the only reason that problems last long at all is we keep looking at them, you know. The minute something gets our attention, the problem's gone. It's like you're on a conveyor belt, you know, and the problems are stationary. And you'll go, oh, no, I knew that was going to happen, you know. And you stare at it. But then somebody over here says, hey, we got a new guy. Who? And the problem's gone. And thinking's not very good. Hey, you're in the right place. You really are. I'll tell you, one time, it's a true story. I get up, get ready to go to work. I got dressed, everything, got in the car. And I'm driving through the streets of Washington, D.C. And I couldn't remember where I worked. That's a true story. And it was like gone. I go, oh, my God, you have to dress up. And but I'm serious. I couldn't remember where I worked, and I panicked. And my sponsor, Dan, had given me a card with his name and phone number, and he taped a dime to it. That's how long ago it was. And so I called him. Now, I knew that Dan didn't want to sponsor someone who had problems. So all I ever reported to Dan were the good things I did, you know. And I called him up, and I didn't want him to know I didn't know where I worked, because I was afraid he'd fire me, and then they'd put me someplace. And so he answered the phone. I said, hi, Dan, it's me, Keith. How are you? He said, I'm fine. How are you? I said, fine. I was just wondering how you're doing. He said, doing fine. He said, what's all the noise, Keith? I said, well, I'm calling you from a phone booth, Dan. And he said, car breakdown? I said, no, Dan, car's fine. He said, what's the problem? I said, well, it's not much of a problem, Dan. I just can't seem to recall where I work. And he said what he always says. Oh, you can't remember where you work problem, huh? He said, a lot of us have had that. I've never met another guy. And he told me, you know, the minute he told me, I said, oh, I knew that. You know, I mean, you know, I even knew what I did. It's like it was all in one big package, you know. And then he said to me, he says, kind of scary, isn't it? And I said, Dan, are you sure I'm an alcoholic? Are you sure I'm just not crazy? He said, oh, you're an alcoholic. He said, now, you may also be crazy. He said, you know, we don't have a corner on anything. He said, but I do know you're an alcoholic. And he said, you know, he said, your brain is, the book says that it's a very unnatural thing to dump a lot of alcohol in your brain. And he said, it's going to take your brain a while to adjust. And he said, but there's two things I want you to remember. And I said, what's that, Dan? He said, well, the first thing is if you have brain damage, you'll forget you have it. And I thought, well, that's encouraging. And he said, the second thing is, he said, if you can remember, he said, if you ever have this problem about not remembering where you work, he said, if you can remember to look at the front bumper of your car, you have a parking permit for the university. And I remember thinking, where do these people learn these things? I mean, they make life look so easy. You know, I mean, just amazing to me. You know, I figured out what sponsorship was all about, too. And if you're new, this is how sponsorship works. A sponsor's a person who's probably not had much to do recently, okay? And their lives are sort of slow and things. And somebody comes up and makes a mistake of asking them to sponsor them. And then they start having fun. And what they do is they find out what you really want to do and tell you you can't do it. So, you know? List your dreams. and everything I wanted to do, Dan used to say, I don't think that's a very good idea. So now I'm at the university one day, and I got there. I remember where I worked, and I got there, and I got a letter from a guy, and he was asking me. I was sober 3 months, and he asked me to come to France to study with him, and he. He was probably the greatest cytologist that ever lived, and I worked in genetics and did a lot of work with chromosomes and things, and he had a technique staining chromosomes, and I knew that Dan wouldn't let me go, so I was not going to give him the satisfaction. I was going to write the good man back and tell him no, thank you. And I thought, well, I'll give him a chance. So we went to lunch. I paid, and at the end of the meeting, I showed him the letter. And he just came apart. He said, my God, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. And I said, you mean I can go? And he said, you have to go. He said, this isn't about you. He said, the best you could do is crap your pants in Skid Row. He said, this is about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, this is about God working through Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what this is about. And I said, I didn't think you'd let me go. He said, you have to go. No question, no discussion. You have to go. And I said, you think I'm ready? He said, of course you're ready. He said, we've got 3 months before you have to go. And he told me something which I find to be true. He said, Keith, you can do anything you're called on to do if you prepare properly. And we began to prepare properly. I got the phone numbers. I did the things. I did the steps. I did all the things I needed to do to get on that plane and go to France. In January the 1st, 1974, I was walking the streets of Paris, a free man. I was overwhelmed. I was just overwhelmed. And I remember when I'd been there when I was in the Marine Corps, and I couldn't get past the bar in the hotel I was staying in. And on the way to the train station to go back to Le Havre to catch the ship, I had a cab driver run by the Eiffel Tower. Because the only thing anybody in Ohio knows about France is the Eiffel Tower. And I knew they'd ask me if I went there, and I didn't want to have to lie. So we drove to the Eiffel Tower. I rode the elevator to the top, found out they served cognac up there, had six, got back on the elevator, came back down, and went to the train. And a short time later, I'm walking the streets of Paris, a free man. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It's all about being a free man. And if you're new, you might say, how do you get free? The only price to get free is to be wrong. It's the only price. I went to this old-timer one time with a problem. I think it was August of 73 problem. And he said to me, he said, you got a lot of problems, don't you? I said, I got a lot of problems. He said, look, I'll tell you what I want you to do. He said, I want you to borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, now, I don't want you doing anything else for the girls in the program. And he said, oh, that's right, you can't. They're vicious. They're vicious. They said, I want you to go home and I want you to write on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, I can't do that, you see, because my problem is I have a poor self-image and I have to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They hadn't read any of those books. And so I went and I bought some lipstick. I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman. And so I went and bought some lipstick, and I went to my little apartment. I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I just, in disgust, I threw it, and I knew you were all crazy. And I went off to bed that night. And remember a normal night, 90 days? Oh, God. You know, I lay down, and for the first time that day, my mind woke up, and it took off. And it was talking, you're never going to make it. They're going to find out you're really not an alcoholic. You're really a crazy man, and all this. It just... all night, you know, all night is going, and finally I drift off to sleep, and then the leg cramps, and, you know, and I jump up and down beside my bed, and then lay back down, and 15 minutes before I had to go to work, I go, sound asleep. It would take 3 alarm clocks to wake me up, you know, and I got up, and my mind was still working on me. So you're going to go to work today, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and you're going to get fired. What difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt, and all this stuff. So I go out, and I start the coffee, and I just want to cry, and I went in the bathroom and I looked on a mirror and said, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. I can tell you that. So the gift, the great gift that Alcoholics Anonymous offers us is ours if we're willing to be wrong. And the more stuff that I'm wrong about, the freer I can be. And that's the key. The key to this whole thing is being wrong. You know, where have I been wrong? Where have I missed it? If you read page 86, 87, 88, it trains us beautifully about how to be wrong and how to learn and how to grow. And what a marvelous trip it is, you know. You know, I tell you, my father never told me he loved me. And you know, and I went to make amends to my father. And I had a hard time. I'd get around him and I'd get angry. And he never did anything. I just got angry. I'd drive from Washington, D.C. to Ohio. It was 300 miles to make amends to my father. I'd sit down with him for 10 minutes. And I'd get up and storm out and drive back. And my dad said to my mother one time, he said, you know, I really like that boy, but I'm worried about him. He said, he drives a long way for a cup of coffee. And so finally I had a little house in a beach house in North Carolina some years ago, and my father had never seen the ocean. He never owned an automobile. All he ever did was work all his life and send a bunch of kids to college and things, and he bought a car after he retired, and the last kid was out of college, and he'd never seen the ocean, and we had the pleasure of taking him to the ocean. And I was leaving to take a position in Alabama at the time, and I said, Dad, I wonder if you and Mom would do me a favor. He said, well, anything. And I said, would you keep an eye on my house for me? And he said, yeah. So I kept an eye on it for 6 years. They kept an eye on the house. And they had a wonderful time. They never had a vacation, and they had a six-year honeymoon after the last kid was gone. And the name of the house was CZ Does It. It was a great place. And I stopped down to see him one time, and it happened. I'd been praying, and I was able to make the direct amends to my father. And he told me some things that I didn't understand. He said, remember when you first started to work? And I said, yeah, Dad, I was 13 years old. He said, yeah. He said, you went to work in a bowling alley. And he said, remember your first day at work? I said, well, I don't think so. And he said, I took you to lunch. He said, I took you to Louis's hot dog stand. And I said, oh. And he said, do you remember what you had? And I said, well, I'm going to go way out on a limb, Dad. Did I have a hot dog? And he said, of course you had a hot dog, you loon. He said, do you remember what you drank? And I said, well, I guess I probably drank an orange pop because I always drank orange pop. And he said, not that day. He said, that day you drank a root beer. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought that men who work drank root beer. And he said, I told you about doing a good day's work for a good day's pay, and that you owed your boss respect and your boss owed you respect. And he said, and I walked you down to the bus station, and I had to take a bus to the next town. And I said to you, son, do you want me to come with you the first day? And you said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, I watched my skinny, tiny, little 13-year-old boy get on a bus. And he said, I watched the bus until it was out of sight. And he said, son, you never looked back. And he said, from that day on, I never felt as though I ever had the right to tell you anything. And the words in our book rang through my head, that most people treat us the way we force them to treat us. And it occurred to me why I owed my father an amends. It wasn't because I worried him, though I did. I was a crazy man. I'd disappear and think I'd be in different countries. It was out of my mind. That isn't why I owed him an amends. I owed him an amends because I denied him the ability to do what he did best, and that was to be my father. And he said to me, he said, from that day on, you never let me do anything for you. He said, you bought all your own clothes. He said, all your brothers and sisters let me help them go to college, and you wouldn't let me do that. And I said, oh, Dad, I'm so sorry. And a few months later, I needed to borrow a few $1,000. Just something came up. And I went to my dad, and I borrowed it. And from then until now, and I paid him back, and from then until now, we've been best friends. And Dad's 85 years old, and he lost his wife of 56 years a couple years ago. My mom contracted cancer, and she died a very difficult and beautiful death. We're talking about it at dinner. She suffered a lot, and she was of the belief that everything she ever did was a prayer, and that suffering was a prayer, and she offered her suffering up for all her children. And those who were in AA for gratitude, and those who weren't yet in AA, and they've since, some of the have since changed. And my brother Larry, who was sober at the time, and he's sober now, but we went up, and it was a blessed time. And my mother loved a rosary, as I always have, and at night I'd go down and pray a rosary aloud, and she'd drift in and out, and she'd smile and say a few Hail Marys with me, and then drift on out. And my sisters, who took care of her so beautifully, like Nancy and her sister took care of their mom, had put the pictures of all 11 of her children and her 21 grandchildren, her 20 great-grandchildren, next to her bed, and she'd just look and smile. And I remember the night that shortly before she died, I was up, and my niece came in, Aaron, who was newly sober, and said, Uncle Keith and Uncle Larry, will you come to the meeting? Barbara's speaking tonight. My sponsor speaking. She's sober 7 years tonight. And I said, well, I said, I maybe another time, honey. I was sort of thinking I'd stay here with Mom. And my mother said, oh, no, son. No, no, no. You go to that meeting. Those are the people who brought my boys home to me. She said, don't you ever not go to those meetings. And, you know, she made a list of the things that she wanted in her coffin. And when I was sober 4 years, I made direct amends to her and asked her if there was anything I could do. And she said, and the first chip I had ever, where I got sober in D.C., they didn't have chips then. And so the first chip I ever got was a four-year chip. And she said, well, I'd like to have one of those coins if I could. And so every year on May the 13th, I sent she and my father a coin. And she listed the things she wanted in her coffin. And at the top of the list was her son's 23-year chip. She loved you so. Because you took a boy that everybody else had given up on, and you brought him home. I have a brother, Terry, who was also alcoholic, and Terry was sober for about 90 days, 20-some years ago, and a miracle didn't happen for him, and not everybody needs to get sober. I know that now, and Terry was the kind of guy who did this stuff drunk that I had to work hard to do sober. He loved people, and he ended up living on the streets like I did, and he lived in the basement of an old house like I did, and he collected aluminum cans, and he'd sell them, and then he'd give half the money to somebody who needed it. And whenever I'd go home to see Terry, he'd always leave town. And so he remained on my 9-step list or 8-step list for a long time. And for my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, I went home and Terry was there. And my wife, Julia, got to meet him. And she immediately loved him. And he came to the 50th anniversary and he was drunk. And my brothers came to me because I'm in charge of drunk in the family. My brothers came to me and said, Terry's here and he's drunk. And I said, well, of course he's drunk. He's an alcoholic. Of course he's drunk. I said, he must love Mom and Dad an awful lot to be here like that. And they looked at me and said, what are you talking about? And I said, I know exactly what he's been through. He's been in a bar just down the street trying to get enough courage to come here. And I said, he must love them very much. And it freed everybody up to love him just exactly the way he was. And so we have a picture. It's on my mirror at home of my parents and their 11 sons and daughters. And Terry standing next to me, and he's passed out with his head on my shoulder. And Terry contracted cancer, and I went to see him. He was in the hospital, and I knew he couldn't run away, and I went home. And one of the problems with getting sober for a while after you go home is they won't leave you alone. And I wanted to go and meet with Terry, but every time I went there, two or three brothers or sisters tagged along. And so I went to Mass Sunday morning with the family, and I said, well, I have to get back to North Carolina. And I ran over to the hospital, and I lied to him, Barbara, and I ran over to the hospital, and I spent about 3 hours with my dear brother, Terry, and he had a lot of questions. He asked me about the rosary and do I pray it, and I said, every day, and I said, and I pray for you every day, and he said, do you happen to have an extra one? And I did, and I showed him how to use it, and a scapular, all the things that it, sort of we grew up with, and then he said, do you really believe there's a God? I mean, really believe there's a God. And I said, I know it more than I know anything. And he said, I sure hope so. And he let me hug him. And when he was young, he was a boxer. He was tough. I mean, he was truly tough. He was a good boxer, and he was mean. And now he's 40-some years old, 44 years old, and he'd been wasted away as a result of alcoholism and then his cancer. And he was very frail. And I could only hug him for a second, and then he pushed away. You remember when you were new how hard it was to be hugged, but he let me hug him for a second. And I recall something I learned when I studied theology. I was given a scholarship, and I went back and took a degree in philosophy and theology at Georgetown. And one of the things that I learned in theology was that there are two kinds of time. There's something called chronos, which is chronological time, and that's going on now, and it's about time for me to sit down. There's something called kairos, which is God's time, and God's time is always right now. And what I realized was that I hugged my brother Terry forever, because I hug him right now. And if you're kind of new or you've been around a while and you're worried about having wasted time and this and that, you know, in God's time, everything gets fixed. In God's time, God's economy, there's time for everything. And it's always now. If you have kids, you can go home and hug them and start now. And you know, if you have parents or loved ones, you know, you can hug them. And even if they can't hug you for long, they can hug you forever. And, you know, Terry died about 5 months later, sober. The last thing he said to me was, I don't think I'll have to drink anymore. And I said, I don't think you will either. And he died surrounded by people who loved him. Not the way alcoholics often die. It's surrounded by people who loved him. and who cherished every moment with him. It can't happen. And he died on my 20th AA birthday. That can't happen. You can't get there from where I was. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, please hang around till the miracle happens. It's perfectly fine to leave Alcoholics Anonymous after the miracle happens. You won't. But it's fine to do. But please don't leave before the miracle happens. Now, I'd like to close by recalling something that happened to me. I moved from Washington, D.C. to Fayetteville, North Carolina in 1980, and then I moved down to Wilmington recently. And I was in a little apartment in Fayetteville, and I was sober about 7 years, and I was reading a big book, and a big book, and I'd come to know God in a very personal way, and I was one of those, the book describes, I got back to the church of my childhood and just love it, and found out I was wrong, and the nuns were right, as much as it hurts, and I just misunderstood all of that. That's why I just misunderstood. And the receiver was broken. But I was sitting on a balcony in this little apartment, and I asked a penetrating question. And I was just overwhelmed with gratitude for what God had put in my life. And I said, "Why me, Father?" And I recalled when I was in that treatment center, I called this estranged wife who I had abused physically, emotionally, spiritually, every way you could. And I said to her, I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "No kidding." And I said, "But why me?" And she said, "Why not you, sweetheart? If anybody deserves it, you do." She hung up. And 7 years later, I'm sitting on a balcony in a little apartment overlooking a lake. And I asked my father, "Father, why me?" And he said, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." We truly are the children of the King. Thank you very much.